mice!
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crinoid Podcast number 20, The Time Warrior. I have on the other end of a Skype line, until Microsoft buy it and destroy it for us all, Martin, a chicken-hearted knave if ever I saw one.
Hello there, how are you doing?
Not bad, thanks, you alright?
Yep, I'm okay.
Good! On into the blind, unreasoning fury, Time Warrior. Gonna give us some context on this one?
I can do, yes. We are looking at season 11 of Doctor Who. It's Pertwee's last season, his fifth year in the role. This story introduces Sarah Jane Smith, that's played by Elizabeth Sladen. It was broadcast from 15th of December 1973 to the 5th of January 74. It's a pseudo-historical story, probably the first real one of those since the Time Meddler, isn't it, I would think.
Oh, I suppose you could say Evil of the Daleks was as well.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
But it's certainly very thin on the ground, and it's the only Pertwee historical one, isn't it?
Yeah, the Time Monster, I guess, could also be looked at in those
if you believe that...
if you believe Atlantis exists, yeah. The story is written by Robert Holmes, at the bequest of Terence Dix, who wanted him to write in The New Companion. It was Dix's idea to go back to a sort of time travelling to the Earth's past. Apparently Robert Holmes wasn't particularly happy about that. And by all accounts, his first draft of this was written as a kind of a mock military communique from a Sontaran warrior to Terran Sedix.
Yes, he was a Sontaran warrior, Holmes, wasn't he?
Yeah, and it eventually got rewritten into a proper script.
Interesting that Robert Holmes was adamant that no historical figures should be in the story, which is quite the reverse of what happens with historical stories these days.
That's right. It was directed by Alan Bromley. Initially, Barry Letts was going to direct this, but around this time, he and Terence Dix got the go-ahead to produce Moonbase 3, their kind of sci-fi short-run show in the 70s. So he reluctantly handed it over to Alan Bromley. Also, interestingly, somebody else apparently was cast as Sarah Jane Smith before Liz Sladen.
Oh, well, that's a myth, apparently.
Well, it depends which book you read, really.
Well, I heard that it was another companion was cast and then decided it didn't work, but the only person ever considered for Sarah Jane Smith was Elizabeth Sladen.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's kind of conflicting views on it, depending on which book you read, but by all accounts, there's a couple of names that kind of crop up linked to this, although it's not proved. One of them's Fiona Gaunt, who eventually appeared as a character in Moonbase 3, and the other one's Michelle Dutrice, who, of course, is Frank Spencer's wife, Betty, in Some Mothers Do Adam.
And that's interesting, because at one point Elizabeth Sladen was considered for the role of Betty as well.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I had a couple of working titles, The Time Fugitive and The Time Survivor. And of course, eventually ended up with The Time Warrior.
The actual sequence of filming for this is slightly unusual, because it was filmed at the end of season 10. So directly about a week after the Green Death filming finished, filming started on The Time Warrior. The same was done the previous season with Carnival of Monsters.
The other interesting thing, of course, about this is it's got a new title sequence. The first story with the kind of time tunnel title sequence.
Yes, the slit scan.
Yes.
Which sounds like a medical procedure.
It does.
Gynecological, perhaps.
It's designed by Bernard Lodge, who apparently designed all the other versions as well. And, of course, it was heavily influenced by 2001, A Space Odyssey, the scene towards the end of that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Interestingly, it's got the whole of Pertwee's body, hasn't it? Rather than just the face.
Yeah, that's quite a spectacular moment, isn't it, where the sort of time tunnel follows the sort of outline of Pertwee's body. It's a brilliant sequence, I think.
Mm.
I think it's the best opening sequence of them all, really. The Baker, early Baker one is very similar, but I think this one has the edge just because the colours are slightly different and because of that moment with Pertwee's body flying through the time tunnel. Very, very good.
Mm, yeah, I mean, I favour the Tom Baker one more because I like his face better than I like Pertwee's body.
I think we'll leave that one all right there.
But yeah, it's great, I think.
Mm. And there's a new logo as well, isn't there, of course, for this one, rather than the sort of slightly stylized Doctor Who lettering. There's the famous Doctor Who diamond logo.
Mm.
Another first is that this is the first time that episodes are called parts, isn't it? You see part one coming up on the screen instead of episode one. Ever since the Savages in 1966, they stopped calling individual episodes individual names, and they were all episode one, two, three, etc. This is the first time we get parts, which I believe is the same today, isn't it? Can't say I've noticed, but I think it is.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm not sure, really. Okay, should we kick off with the story itself?
Hmm. It opens with a slightly disappointing scene of a white light flying through the night sky, and it just doesn't look that good. It doesn't really look much better than the opening scene from Spirit from Space several years earlier, which is a very similar scene. Incidentally, the DVD version of The Time Warrior, there are CGI revisions of some of the special effects, aren't there, on the DVD, and you can switch them on and watch the whole story with those CGI effects in, or watch it as it originally broadcast. The CGI version is much better. You actually see the Sontaran spaceship flying down towards the Earth and sort of getting a bit hot as it enters the atmosphere.
Mm. I didn't know that, actually. I hadn't picked up on that, so I've not watched those effects, unfortunately.
Well, you can watch the whole thing afresh.
Mm, I shall.
Next time, do your homework before the podcast.
Balls to you.
I say. I think Martin meant the ball is in my court for continuing the story.
Correct.
So no need for any explicit tag there. And we then enter a medieval hall with a pair of miserable blokes with beards at a meal table, one of which turns out to be the robber Baron Irongron, played by David Dacre.
Mm.
Incidentally, this role was offered to the legendary Cockney actor Bob Hoskins. He turned the role down, but recommended David Dacre, and very glad he did, because he puts in a great performance. Dacre returns to Doctor Who in Nightmare of Eden, which Alan Bromley also directed. It's the only other story that Bromley directed. The other chap at the table is Irongron's second-in-command, Bloodaxe. They're complaining about the sour wine and the sort of off meat that they're being served up. And Irongron's spitting wine out and throwing a tantrum. Also throwing a tankard at Meg, the serving wench.
It's funny that bit, because he throws it at her, but it hits, or it covers the blokes. There's a bloke sitting by the fire and they're asleep, I think he is. It all goes over him and he kind of gets up and looks a bit annoyed and
goes back down to sleep again. Yeah, you can tell that David Dacre's throwing to miss, isn't he? Want to hit the actress, but yeah, it's great because it spreads all over him, and a lot of it's all over Irongron's face around the scene.
Yeah.
But yeah, it seems that they're on slightly hard times, doesn't it? Bloodaxe says it's a while since they've been out of foraging and all their supplies are low.
Mm.
And Irongron's very envious of their neighbours in the neighbouring castle eating and drinking very well, and they decide it'd be a good idea to pop over there and rob Sir Edward of some of his abundance.
Mm. Yeah, and they hear this spaceship, don't they, that we've seen in the very first scene. And Bloodaxe rushes over to the window and looks out, and there's you see this light descending. Again, it's a pretty poor effect, really. But he thinks it's a falling star. Stars are falling!
What a perfect impression.
Yeah, and you see it kind of glowing on the ground, and Irongron goes over and has a look as well, and he's quite excited. He thinks it's fallen in the forest nearby, and he wants to go out to get it. He sort of claims it as his own, says it's Irongron's star. Bloodaxe, though, is scared to go out in the dark, isn't he?
Yeah. Who knows what demons may set upon us? another perfect impression.
Yeah. It's as if they were in the room with us, isn't it? he wants to wait until dawn, but which is apparently only an hour away. Although why they're up at this hour, eating and drinking, it's a bit strange. But,
Well, they don't follow a 9-to-5 working day, these people, do they?
True. Irongrun calls them all chicken-hearted knaves, doesn't he?
Yes.
And he kind of raises his axe at them, although Blood Axe kind of stops him, and he sort of convinces him that they will wait until dawn. So Irongrun calls for some more wine, even though Meg's already told him it, what she'd poured before was the last.
Yeah, and it was sour, so...
Yeah.
Never mind. Yeah, why not toast it with some sour wine?
Yeah.
Speaking of sour, Barry Letts was a bit fed up with Alan Bromley on this scene, because Alan Bromley kept saying, yeah, don't worry, I'll do the falling spaceship, that'll be fine, it'd be brilliant. And of course, it wasn't. Barry Letts was a bit fed up with. But again, that's been CGI'd up, and it looks pretty good if you watch it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But we get the first segment of quite a lot of location footage in this story. Another sort of a myth here was that all this was filmed near Warwick Castle, which I grew up believing my entire youth and adult life. It turns out it's Peckforton Castle in Cheshire, which explains why the few times I've been to Warwick Castle, I didn't recognise it at all as being anything to do with the Time Warrior, but there you go, it's in Peckforton Castle. And they shoot a bit in the grounds where there's a wooded area with a kind of clearing where there's a spherical spaceship. Now iconic spherical Suntaran spaceship.
Mm.
Sure enough, as they approach, the door opens and a squat figure appears, that of a Suntaran.
Yeah, at this point, as they approach on the horseback, Blood Axe's horse is all over the place, isn't it?
Yes.
And in fact, you kind of look at his face, I think he's kind of smiling or laughing, isn't he? His horse is hopping around all over the place.
He seems to be quite a good horseman, that actor. It's John J. Carney, isn't it, the actor?
Mm.
There's another scene where he really handles a horse very well indeed. And obviously, they perhaps given him the most difficult horse, as he's probably the best horseman there. Mm. But they eventually make it without breaking their necks. And this figure emerges, and Irongrun sort of challenges it and raises his axe to attack him. But the figure raises... a sort of a weapon-like device and blasts the axe from Irongrun's hand.
Yes, he does. And he then kind of adjusts a device on his belt, which I presume is translating what he says, isn't it?
Yes.
And then he starts speaking, and he says that he comes in peace, he won't harm them, and that he's a Suntaran officer called Lynx. He then plants a kind of staff in the ground, which the top turns into a flag, doesn't it? And he claims the planet, its moons and satellites, for the greater glory of the Suntaran Empire, and salutes.
Yeah, I didn't know all this time we were under Suntaran rule. Never mind. There's a nice bit, isn't there, where this Lynx describes himself as a Suntaran. Blood Axe mishears this as Saracen, doesn't he? And he says he's heard talk of their eastern magic. the whole thing about this sort of translating device in Lynx's belt, it's quite odd because he has a quite antiquated way of speaking, doesn't he, Lynx? Mm. And I wondered if he's kind of patched into, you know, the same sort of speech as Irongrun and Blood Axe and the rest of them, rather than just human English speech in general.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, because a lot of the ways he speaks is quite antiquated. It makes for quite an interesting character, I think.
Definitely, yeah. We then cut to back at the castle, don't we, where Irongrun is asking Lynx why they should help him. You know, why shouldn't they just kill him and ransack his ship? Lynx warns him that if they do that, they'll destroy themselves. He asks Irongrun if he's a warrior, which he says he is, that everyone around, you know, pays tribute to him. And Lynx asks about, you know, has he got any enemies? And he offers Irongrun magic weapons so that he can become the supreme warrior, you know, in his area. In return, Lynx wants shelter, somewhere to repair his ship, because the drive mechanism is damaged. And then he starts talking about needing skilled technicians and complex equipment, which obviously, you know, isn't going to be around in sort of medieval times. So Lynx decides that he must find these things from somewhere else.
Yes. Yeah, it's an interesting scene, because we heard a little bit about Irongrun's background, don't we? They took that castle by force of arms and slew everybody in it.
Mm.
So he's a fairly bloodthirsty, ruthless kind of bloke. It's an interesting bit because Lynx is surrounded, where he has Bloodaxe and Iron Grin in front of him, and he's kind of surrounded by their men, all with their swords drawn. And at one point he looks like he has a look around and calculates the risk of taking them all on and decides that, you know, discretion is the best part of valour and decides that he's going to have to bargain with Iron Grin. Yeah, it's a little hint of, you know, also how kind of bloodthirsty Lynx is.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because that carries on throughout the story, doesn't it, that they both have things that the other one wants, and they actually say that in the dialogue a couple of times, don't they?
Yeah, it's a very uneasy alliance, isn't it?
Mm.
Yes, but then we moved, although it's a Georgian house that we moved to, it's actually the present day, or at least in the 1970s.
Mm.
There's soldiers milling about, appear to be building cubicles into this room and setting up camp beds all around, with some disgusting mattresses, I don't know if you noticed.
Piss stained.
horribly, horribly stained. Anyway, that's what these scientists, it turns out, are going to have to sleep on. The Doctor and Brigadier appear. Obviously, this is Pertwee, the third Doctor, and the late, great Nicholas Courtney. And we learn that apparently they're setting up emergency accommodation for a number of scientists in what is a top-secret security establishment. It's a kind of research centre, isn't it? It's very well guarded with security details and alarm systems.
No, the Brigadier says it is, but it's not. As we're about to find out.
Yes, maybe that's never the truth. But Brigadier's been a little bit sort of cagey about it all, isn't he? And eventually the Doctor kind of winkles out at him what's going on. Apparently half a dozen leading scientists have gone missing, along with several million pounds worth of ultra-secret equipment. These scientists have been working on space hardware, new alloys, guidance systems and methods of propulsion. Coincidentally, the very sort of things that Lynx is looking for.
Mm, funny that.
Mm.
And the Brigadier's had this room designed with these cubicles in it so that he can get all the scientists into one place, making it easier for him to guard them. So we cut back to medieval times and Lynx is in down the dungeons of this castle, isn't he, somewhere. But he's converted it into a laboratory where he's... The spaceship's actually inside as well in this room. There's lots of kind of wooden benches around, but lots of scientific equipment on it. And a load of scientists in pyjamas with kind of headphones on their heads. But also some of Argrund's men who don't have these headphones, which is a bit odd, I thought. You know, so the scientists are there with these headphones and they look very vacant and they're obviously being controlled in some way. So are Argrund's men, but presumably... Argrund's men are so stupid that they don't need the extra bit of kit to control them.
Well, maybe it's because the scientists are linked into that program, aren't they, which the Doctor has a go at later on.
Mm.
So I think their work is kind of being monitored, whereas these you know, primitives are just wandering around with rifles and stuff, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, they're probably just fetching and carrying, really, aren't they? Yeah, so.
Yeah, I don't think they're part of that. They've probably just been hypnotised. And aren't part of the program, I think. But, they are bringing rifles around, which, of course, is completely anachronistic for the early Middle Ages.
Mm.
And it's a slight issue. It's probably best not to think about it. It's how they got Lynx's spaceship into this dungeon through quite a narrow door. We don't know what's on the sort of camera side of the room, but I can't imagine there's anything big enough to let the that spaceship in. But nevertheless, it's there.
Mm, that's true. Maybe they dismantled it and... put it back together again. Or maybe they just took a window out. That's how you normally get large objects in, isn't it?
Yeah, that's probably it, yeah.
Mm. Bloodaxe knocks on the door, calling for Lord Lynx, telling him that Argrim wants a word with him. Lynx tells him that he's busy and mutters to himself, "Insolent primitives, did I not need their help? Dot, dot, dot." Bloodaxe reporting back to Argrim. And there's a great... kind of line to follow that. Argon says, "Instant barbarian, did I not need his help?"
It's great. They're both in that same position, aren't they?
They're
frustrated by the other person, but they actually need them.
Mm. Argon shows Bloodaxe a rifle that Lynx has given him, and he shoots at an apple that's kind of, he places on a wall nearby, doesn't he? He obviously misses it. Bloodaxe sort of holds his ears as it shouts, "Claps the ears!" Obviously shocked by this noise that it's making.
Mm.
Apparently it's Cox's orange pippin, isn't it, which is anachronistic for this time. But,
oh, really?
apparently, yeah.
Another thing that doesn't quite work is the gun goes off in Iron Grun's hand, doesn't it, before he's really shot it. I think the prop it fires too early.
Yeah, well, that's fine. I mean, I think that, you know, it sort of shows that he doesn't really know what he's doing with it, doesn't it? So.
Yeah, adds to the general buffoonery of
Buffoons.
Yes, talking of buffoons, back at the research centre, a chap called Joseph Rubish introduces himself to the doctor. He introduces himself as Rubish, doesn't he? Which the doctor thinks is some sort of insult before he realises that's his name.
Yeah.
He goes straight into complaining about being locked up like a bunch of kids and calling the Brigadier a military idiot. The doctor tells him that he means well. And Rubish goes on to say he hasn't seen his wife and family for 3 days, so every cloud has a silver line.
Yeah, the doctor likes that, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
The doctor introduces himself as Dr. John Smith. And then a young woman enters, doesn't she? Rubish introduces her to the doctor as Lavinia Smith, and the two shake hands. The doctor says that he's read Lavinia's paper on virology, but that it's interesting because she must have been 5 when she'd written it. So he's kind of exposed this person straight away as not being who she says she is. And she explains that Lavinia's her aunt, and she is Sarah Jane Smith.
Hey!
So Lavinia Smith had been invited along to join the other scientists here, but obviously couldn't make it, so Sarah took her invite. She's actually a journalist, and she thought there might be a good story. Which goes to kind of back up what I was saying about the fact that this is supposed to be the best guarded establishment in the country, and yet somebody can just come in, pretend to be somebody else. A journalist, no less.
That happens all the time, as you know, but yeah, clearly they haven't checked ages or anything, have they?
Anyway, the doctor says he's not going to give her away because she can make herself useful by making him a cup of coffee.
Yes, of course, she goes nuts about this, doesn't she? It's interesting that Sarah Jane Smith is written as a very sort of feminist character, isn't she? Which is supposed to be a reaction to, you know, the Dolly Bird screamers that we've become used to at this stage in Doctor Who's history. In order to prove this, all the other characters become more sexist than usual, don't they? You know, the doctor says loads more sexist stuff than he usually does. And, well, they're in quite a sexist time in the Middle Ages anyway.
Yeah. But,
there's a lot of sexist remarks all of a sudden just to allow her to react and show the audience that she's quite a strong feminist.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that it's sort of necessary to do it, you know, for the doctor to be making those remarks when clearly for most of the story, it would have fitted in nicely in the medieval times for them to be sexist, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think they could have had Rubish talking about her making coffee rather than the doctor.
There's obviously straight away there's a kind of a spark between the doctor and Sarah, isn't there?
Yes, they don't get on straight away, do they? But there's certainly a bit of repartee.
Mm. The doctor tells Rubish off for writing equations on the TARDIS, doesn't he? And then he goes inside to make himself a cup of coffee.
Then we move to Sir Edward's castle. This is obviously the neighbour of Iron Grun and his cronies. And we go into the sort of Great Hall. It's just quite an impressive set, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it's sort of well-dressed and everything, and it's quite a sort of high hall that they're in. They're obviously quite well-to-do, Sir Edward and Lady Eleanor. Lady Eleanor, incidentally, is played by June Brown, who millions of people in the UK will know as Dot Cotton, or Dot Browning, I believe she is these days. And she's complaining about Iron Grun. And Sir Edward is a rather sort of feeble chap, isn't he?
Yes.
Quite defeatist. He says he's got no troops, you know, with which to do anything about Iron Grun, because they're all off with the king fighting his interminable wars, which I assume is the Crusades.
Mm.
But he has actually got some sort of plan in motion, isn't he? Because he believes that if all the neighbours are all fed up of Iron Grun, if they all gather together the remaining forces that they each have into one fighting force, they might be able to crush Iron Grun. And apparently he sent letters out to each of these neighbours suggesting the idea.
Yeah, and then we cut back to Iron Grun's castle, where Bloodaxe and some of the other men are bringing in Sir Edward's squire, who they've found in the forest. He has with him one of these letters to the neighbours. Neither Bloodaxe or Iron Grun can read this letter. Iron Grun threatens the squire, but he's not going to speak, so they take him away to loosen his tongue. It's quite funny, actually. Bloodaxe says that he tried to eat this letter when he was caught. And Iron Grun says, are Sir Edward's men so ill-fed? And they fall about laughing, don't they?
Yeah, there's lots of big manly laughs, aren't there, in amongst Iron Gron and his crew.
There is, and what's funny is that Iron Gron kind of laughs and then looks at the others to make sure that they're laughing, doesn't he?
Oh, it's brilliant, brilliant stuff. Incidentally, one of Iron Gron's men holding the messenger appears to be Nigel Tufnell from Spinal Tap.
Yeah, I think I know which one you mean. He's hilarious in some of these scenes. It's clearly not an actor. I don't know where they got him from.
Oh, God, yeah, a lot of people seem to be dragged off the street, don't they, for this?
Yeah.
Back to Sir Edward's castle. Sir Edward is worried that his squire hasn't returned, and he hasn't eaten, and Lady Eleanor's worried about him. But she tells Sir Edward that Iron Gron's been seen walking his battlements every morning. And she wonders whether an archer could turn up there one morning and assassinate the chap. that gives the feeble Sir Edward some hope.
Iron Gron, meanwhile, is swinging his axe around like a madman. For some reason, obviously doing some practice axe swinging. When Lynx enters, Iron Gron asks why he can't see his face, and Lynx says that he might not find his appearance particularly pleasing. Iron Gron's riposte is, "By my sword, Lynx, I'll wager you're the finest beauty in the castle."
It probably is.
Yeah. Yeah, you got Sheila Fay playing Meg. Apparently one of the other extras in the kitchen is Bella Renberg. Although I didn't...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't notice which one she was.
I saw one that looked a bit like Bella Renberg, but I didn't think it was her, because she's a lot younger than we used to.
Yeah, it was her. Yeah, Iron Gron asks for Lynx's help with the prisoner. Lynx says, yeah, he'll be able to make him speak. Iron Gron at this point says that he thinks that he's going to be attacked and that he's effectively is at war. And Lynx gets very excited by this, doesn't he? And then he boasts about the Sontarans, that there isn't a galaxy in the universe which the Sontaran space fleets haven't subjugated, and that the Sontarans have been at war for millennia. Iron Gron looks at him very blankly at this point, doesn't he? Because he hasn't got a clue what he's talking about. And he asks for the weapons that Lynx has promised him. He says, "We make good allies. Each of us has got much that the other wants." When he says that, Lynx kind of spins round and looks at him, doesn't he?
Yeah, a bit offended, isn't he?
A bit offended.
Yes, so yeah, we learned a bit more about the Sontarans there. Back at the research place, Rubish has discovered that Sarah's an imposter. Someone's told him that Lavinia Smith's in America. So Rubish is worried that she's a spy and wonders whether they should tell the Brigadier about her. But just as he's confiding this in the doctor, Sarah turns up. So Rubish sort of storms off to his cubicle in disgust, doesn't he? The doctor's working on some sort of gizmo, isn't he, on the desk, and Sarah spots it and asks what it is. He says it's his alarm clock, and she tells him off for being patronised. He then explains what it is. It is a sort of alarm clock because it's a rondium sensor which detects delta particles. It makes a noise, and if he's asleep, it'll wake him up if these delta particles are detected. She asks him why he wants to be woken up when delta particles are there, and he says he's very fond of them, which is another patronising reply, really.
Yeah.
He then ratchets the patronisation up to huge levels, doesn't he, and sort of waves her away and basically tells her to go away and go to sleep. So, he's not winning any friendship from Sarah at this point.
No. So she kind of scuttles off to one of the cubicles. Rubish immediately comes out, asking again if they should tell the Brigadier about Sarah, but he says, we'll leave it till the morning.
If we're all still here.
If we're all still here, yes. Back in the Middle Ages, Bloodaxe brings the prisoner back to Iron Gron, and Lynx is also there, and he uses his magic wand, points into the prisoner's face, and it immediately kind of relaxes, doesn't it? And Lynx says that he's now unlocked the prisoner's mind, and Iron Gron can question him, which he duly does, asking how many men guard Sir Edward's castle. Eric, the squire, says there's only 10 men, most of them are old. He tells him that Sir Edward's sending messages out to raise a force against Iron Gron. Iron Gron laughs and says, he can't stop babbling.
Yes, he's slightly disappointed, isn't it, that Lynx doesn't have at him to loosen his tongue, but he's quite impressed by the results of Lynx's sort of mind probe.
Mm. Yeah, Lynx's kind of magic wand does kind of all sorts of things, doesn't it? You know, he can use it like this to unlock somebody's mind, or hypnotise people, it can kill people, it can stun people, it can do all sorts of things.
It's the Sontaran equivalent of a Swiss Army knife.
Or a sonic screwdriver, of course.
Yes. Well, I believe it's got a function for getting the stones out of horses' hooves as well.
Handy in the Middle Ages.
Very handy, yes. But yes, after he's unlocked Eric's mind, Lynx goes to leave the room, doesn't he? But Irongrim bars his way with an axe. Lynx, rather clumsily, unfortunately, aims. He's only got three digits on his hand, which makes things rather difficult. He aims his weapon, stroke wand, stroke toothbrush, whatever it is, at Irongrim's axe. It bursts into flames, and he storms out. Irongrim, of course, is furious at Lynx's insolence and promises to pickle the Star Warrior in boiling oil one day.
Yes, he does. Back in the present, the Doctor is woken by his alarm clock, which starts to rotate and give off a noise. He calls out to Rubish, who answers him, and then Sarah comes out of her cubicle, still kind of fully dressed. She's obviously not got any pyjamas with her. All the scientists seem to be wearing the same pyjamas, don't they?
They're not all in the same pair of pyjamas.
Just one big pair. Anyway, she comes out. The noise this machine is making kind of increases in pitch, doesn't it? And then there's another sound from Rubish's room, and they burst in to find that he's gone. His glasses are still on the bed, aren't they? So Sarah says he can't have gone far. The Doctor checks outside the room and asks one of the, well, there's a couple of guards, unit guards outside, aren't there? And he asks them if they saw anybody leave. But of course, clearly, they couldn't have done, because the doctor didn't see anybody go past anyway, did he?
Worth checking.
Worth checking, I suppose. But then the Doctor's got this, another machine, isn't he, that it's kind of like a black box type thing, which he kind of waves around, and it shows an image of Lynx on the staircase. A trigger-happy guard immediately raises his gun and shoots at it, because it's only an image, and it's not really there. And the two guards rush up the stairs and look bewildered, don't they?
Yeah, which is a unit guard's speciality, isn't it? Mm. There's a couple of points about this. One is that there is a CGI version of this. In the original, you just see the Doctor waving this sort of torch thing around, and there's no visual effect to go with it until the Sontaran is revealed at the top of the stairs. There is a CGI effect of a kind of field coming out of this torch thing and picking out the Sontaran, but it looks far too high-tech for the programme, really.
Mm.
It looks out of place, because there are no other effects like that. So in this case, I think it's actually better as it was originally.
I don't think there's anything wrong with it in the original, really.
No, I think you can clearly see what's happening, and you can see that it reveals Lynx. I'm not quite sure why Lynx is standing there, rather than sort of moving about. He's literally just standing, isn't he?
Yeah, and why is he on the staircase? Doesn't quite make any sense, but...
Mm. And why isn't Rubish with him?
Yeah, a bit odd.
But anyway, it gives him a clue that something's going on.
Mm. At this point, the Brigadier arrives, doesn't he? And he's saying that they're under attack. Sarah hides in a cubicle from the Brigadier. I'm not sure why she does that.
Yeah.
You know, because obviously she's been let in, and, you know, she must have some sort of pass. So, but she goes to hide. The Doctor has obviously gone into the TARDIS, and he now comes out again, and he's got a briefcase with him, and he starts kind of packing up all his equipment. While he's talking to the Brigadier, telling him that Rubish has gone missing. Brigadier's response is that the Minister all goes spare. The Doctor says he thought he saw a man in armour, and he tells the Brigadier that somebody's operating a matter transmitter across time from several centuries ago. And he thinks he's on the trail of it. While he's talking to the Brigadier, Sarah creeps behind the two of them, doesn't she? And she sort of pokes her head in the TARDIS, calling for Rubish, and basically goes inside. The Brigadier's worried about the Doctor using the TARDIS. It reminds him of what happened when he tried to get to Metabellis 3. But the Doctor basically just leaves, and the TARDIS dematerialises.
Yes. Then we get back to the Middle Ages, and Hal is basically preparing to shoot Irongrim with an arrow as Irongrim's on his battlements. And he hears the TARDIS materialise, and you see some birds sort of scatter in the trees, don't you? Then we switch to the TARDIS, so the Doctor gets out and pats the old girl. Not Sarah, she's still in the TARDIS. And then sort of wanders off, and then a few moments later, a rather stunned Sarah comes out of the TARDIS, looks at it again, sees it's still a police box, and decides she needs to go and find a phone box somewhere.
Yeah, interesting point about this. You know, the Doctor clearly is able to pilot the TARDIS very well now, isn't he? Last season, season 10, he got his memories back from the Time Lords.
Mm.
But what I read into this was that they didn't just give him his memory back. They must have actually given him a bit more than he had before, because, you know, suddenly he can now pilot the TARDIS where he wants to go, whereas previously he couldn't really, could he?
Yeah.
It's very hit and miss. But he's now much more accurate at doing it, isn't he?
Yeah, he seems to be. Yeah, I mean, I can't remember specifically, but as time goes on, I suspect if the plot requires it, he won't be good at piloting it accurately. Certainly works this time, doesn't it?
Mm. So Irongrond and Bloodaxe are up on the battlements of the castle, aren't they? And we see Howl the Archer taking aim and is about to fire when Sarah basically puts him off by asking where the nearest telephone is. And he loses his arrow, but it narrowly misses Irongrond, and he kind of runs off into the forest. Bloodaxe orders his men to get after Hal. Sarah, though, thinks that it's some kind of village pageant, doesn't she? And she's kind of laughing and walking nonchalantly towards these men. One of Irongrond's men grabs Sarah and grapples with her and starts to drag her into the castle, and she's struggling like mad while the other men sort of follow after Hal. The doctor's watching all this, isn't he? Wondering how Sarah got there. And he follows after Sarah, you know, inside the castle walls, and we get to the courtyard in the middle where he hears a noise and he kind of hides behind some boxes, and Lynx appears out of the one of the doorways. The doctor kind of nods to himself, doesn't he, so as if he obviously recognises him. He recognises him from the image on the staircase, doesn't he? But you also get the impression that he knows who he is anyway. We later find out that he does know about Sontarans.
Yes.
And we get a quite wonderful, iconic moment, don't we, where Lynx removes his helmet and turns to the camera, licking his lips, and the episode ends.
Yeah, brilliant.
Mm.
I remember this moment as it was broadcast, actually.
Me too.
All right, yeah, I was about five. Yeah, it was just absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
He had quite that sort of menacing way of moving about, doesn't he, Lynx, before this moment. But, you know, of course, it's a big Doctor Who thing, isn't it, to reveal a horrible face at some point. Particularly Robert Holmes likes doing that, doesn't he? But this is one of the best in the show's history, isn't it? Because it's just a fantastic mask, and it's so kind of unexpected, really, for his head to be the same shape as his helmet.
Yeah, it is. It's obviously, it's a John Friedlander mask, isn't it?
Yeah, he's the governor, wasn't he, of all time, really, on Doctor Who, I think, for doing the masks.
Mm.
Draconin's, Ogron's, Davros, is brilliant.
Yeah, so very, very effective episode ending. Part two opens with Hal the Archer being captured, and he's kind of dragged in to see Irongrond. He's brought in through the castle gates. Lynx puts his helmet back on and goes back inside, and the Doctor also kind of goes into the castle to hide from the men. Inside, Irongrond is overseeing one of his men sharpening an axe when Bloodaxe brings in Sarah, who's obviously still struggling and complaining at being manhandled. And she thinks it's all a pantomime, and, you know, she's shocked when Irongrond basically grabs the gold chain around her neck and just pulls it off her, doesn't he? Saying, you know, she's wearing gold. She calls him a fool, which he doesn't like at all, does he? He says, "I'll have the marrow from your bones, my little chicken." Sarah's getting more and more angry, and she suggests that he go back to his butcher's shop. Threatens them with calling the police. Irongrond at this point tells Bloodaxe to let her go. She sort of says, "Well, thank you, you're being sensible," and she asks for the telephone. But just then, Hal is brought in by Irongrond's men, and Irongrond asks if it was him that shot at him up in the battlements. He says it was, and if it wasn't for Sarah putting off his aim, Irongrond would be dead. Irongrond asks if Edward sent him, but he says no, it was Eleanor. He says, "Ah, oh, that narrow-hipped vixen." And they take Hal away, don't they? And Irongrond says, "Ere long, we shall deal with him sharply." Some great dialogue in this. Absolutely hilarious, some of it.
Yeah, it's great. And after the sharply gag, they all laugh for several minutes.
Yeah.
Which is good. It's interesting that he actually, Irongrond calls Hal a treacherous dog, doesn't he?
Mm.
Well, Hal is his enemy, so it's not really treachery, is it, to be honest?
Not really.
But never mind. Anyway, Sarah, at one point during this inquisition, just admits she doesn't know what the hell's going on, does she?
Mm.
And she tells them, after Hal's been dragged out, that she's scared out of her wits, and could they tell her what's going on? It's just a great blank face from David Dacre, isn't there, as Irongrond, and she starts banging on.
Mm.
He doesn't understand what she's talking about. Bloodaxe suggests that the wench might be crazed. Irongrond thinks it's a shame if she is, as she's not uncomely.
Yeah. She's trying to guess what it is. She says it's not a village pageant or a film set. There's no cameras. She thinks it's one of those tourist places where people sort of dress up and stuff. She continues along these lines, doesn't she? Accusing them of being a bit over the top on the sordid realism. But at this point, Lynx enters, doesn't he? And Eingren asks about his weapons again. He says he's got a new one to show him. He spots Sarah at this point, doesn't he, and asks about her. And he's surprised that there are two species on the planet. And he goes over to her and starts inspecting her, saying that her hair is finer and the thorax of a different construction. Eingren sort of says to Lynx, you know, are there no girls beyond the stars, no women to do the lowly work? And then Lynx realises that obviously there's a primary and secondary reproductive system on this planet. And he remarks how inefficient it is, should change it. Not quite sure how you go about changing that, but...
Eingren's probably not the man to set that in motion either.
No. Nice bit of dialogue from Lynx, that he's saying that the Sontarans, at their military academy, they hatch a million cadets in each muster parade.
Yeah, they can sustain very heavy casualties and still carry on, can't they? Because there's millions of them. Lynx then notices that Sarah's jacket is machine-woven, so therefore she can't be from Eingren's time. So he then uses his handy Swiss penknife mind key on her. And quite oddly just says, who, what, how? And then she replies, Sarah Jane Smith, a reporter, in a machine. I did not understand it. She's also zombified at this point. She reveals she's from the 20th century, but Lynx knows that somehow the 20th century Earth doesn't have time technology. And then she says that the time machine belongs to the Doctor. And Lynx gets quite worried that his mission is being threatened, and gets further information from Sarah. He tells him that the Doctor's a scientist at the research centre. He's very fond of delta particles and will be there somewhere because he came with her in the time machine.
Mm. Anyway, Eingren wants to see his new weapon, doesn't he? And Lynx operates a control device that he's got in his hand. And this robot enters the room, doesn't it? Sort of dressed in Sontaran armour, but with a kind of a knight's helmet on its head. Eingren's amazed by this, and he starts questioning this person, which obviously doesn't respond. And he's all ready to kind of attack it. And Lynx explains that it will fight and kill for Eingren, and it can't be killed itself. Eingren's very happy about this, isn't he? And he's asked for more such soldiers. And he thinks with them he can basically take over the world. Become king. While this is all going on, Sarah manages to creep past in a way, doesn't she? Which Lynx notices she's gone, and Eingren says, oh, don't worry, she'll not get far before one of my guards grabs her tail.
Yeah, which is strange, because in the words of the League of Gentlemen, Sarah's actually a no-tail, isn't she?
Exactly.
But anyway, yeah, Lynx also says it would amuse him to think of Eingren ruling the Earth after he's left, which is quite strange. He clearly doesn't like the bloke, but he gains some sort of weird military amusement out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But Lynx adjusts the control, doesn't he? And this robot knight starts slashing at Eingren's banqueting table.
He does.
Yeah, because you could really chip that, you know. You'd have to have it resurfaced, or maybe even have to go to IKEA and get another one.
Yeah, comes with quite a lot of stick, that table, for his story, doesn't it?
It does.
Anyway, out of the corridor, Sarah bumps into the Doctor, but immediately runs away again. She's frightened of him, and the Doctor kind of calls out to stop her, but, you know, she's gone. And he hides again, because Hal is then brought past by some of Eingren's men. And Hal is taken outside into the courtyard, and his head is put on a block, and Bloodax basically raises his axe, ready to chop his head off. Eingren stops him, though, and he says to Hal, are you a fighter? He says, yeah, I'll fight any man. He says, we'll fight against this, and he basically operates the control, and the robot knight appears. Yeah, Bloodax a bit put out by the fact that Eingren thinks this knight is his champion. Presumably Bloodax thinks that he is, it should be him that's his champion. But then he's worried about pitting Hal and his arrows against somebody with a sword. He says, the arrows will pierce the armour. He won't stand a chance. Eingren just laughs manically, doesn't he? He starts twisting this control box. And, the robot advances on Hal, who starts sticking arrows in it, but he just keeps going. It's quite funny. David Taker really gets into this, doesn't he? He's manically just kind of grinning and wiggling this sort of joystick thing. You would think that the robot would just be swirling around in circles the way he's operating yeah. the thing, but yeah.
Randomly yanking the controls.
Mm.
Yes. A quick word on Jeremy Bullock plays Hal.
Mm.
He has appeared in Doctor Who before as Tor in the Space Museum in the William Hartnell's era. I don't even remember that, but he had, along with the other people, he's raised some comedy eyebrows 3 inches above their own eyebrows. Bizarrely, he also plays Boba Fett in the Star Wars films.
Mm.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
It is bizarre. It's not quite as bizarre as David Prowse playing Darth Vader, though, is it?
I won't be there when you cross the road. Yeah, that is all a little bit weird. Thank God they got James Earl Jones to do the voice. Otherwise, it wouldn't have struck quite the same menacing figure.
No.
But anyway, back to the story. Everyone is laughing, as usual. They laugh at anything, don't they? Iron Gron's mob. It's just robots wandering around with arrows in it. Meanwhile, the doctor's crept up behind some soldiers who are laughing on the battlements and finds a crossbow and takes aim. Hal is being borne down upon by this robot, and he falls over for some reason. And is about to be slain when the doctor shoots the control out of Iron Grun's hand with a crossbow bolt.
Mm.
Yeah, so this causes a robot, unfortunately, which has a human face clearly visible through its visor, to go on the rampage. It starts to take on Iron Grun, who chops its head off. And then the robot suddenly has an extremely long body,
yeah.
as the actor's head is clearly at shoulder height.
Mm.
And it falls to the ground, but it keeps moving its limbs like a tadpole, though, Iron Grun says. And, of course, everyone laughs again. It's all fun at Iron Grun Towers.
It's a laugh a minute. You know, keep on his right side, though, because otherwise they might be laughing at your expense.
Yes, of course.
Mm. Anyway, yeah, Sarah whistles at Hal and sort of beckons him over, and he kind of runs over to join her. Iron Grun wants to go and have words with Lynx about this robot, and Sarah and Hal escape, get away, don't they? We're back in Lynx's workshop, and the Doctor is kind of behind this iron-barred window, isn't he, looking in. Iron Grun knocks at the door, demanding to see Lynx, who says he's busy. Iron Grun sort of batters the door open, doesn't he, and breaks in. And we see Lynx... Or he sees Lynx for the first time not wearing his helmet. Mm. And he kind of is astonished at his grotesque face.
Great look on Iron Grun's face.
Yeah. He says, "Are they also fair of face beyond the stars?" to which Lynx's response is, "Do you think your primitive features are pleasing to me?" Brilliant. Iron Grun tells Lynx about what's happened with this robot. Lynx thinks that maybe the manual control box was a mistake. He says he'll work on a voice control for the next time, you know. And he leaves with Iron Grun to go to deactivate the robots. Doctor removes this iron bar window, doesn't he? Just sort of pulls it out and it all comes out in one piece. Manages to climb through into the workshop. Pokes his head into Lynx's spaceship and has a quick look inside. And then he tries to talk to one of the brainwashed scientists. He recognises one of them, doesn't he? But obviously he doesn't get a response. The scientist just kind of walks past him. But then he spots Rubish. Who is there? He's not been hypnotized. Rubish says he thinks that, you know, it didn't work on him because he's strong-minded. But the Doctor realizes it's much more to do with the fact that he's almost blind without his glasses. So, you know, Lynx's thing is obviously, you know, an optical device that hypnotizes people.
So the Doctor tells Rubish to kind of prepare himself and then announces that he's been taken back to the early Middle Ages. Rufus's reaction is great, isn't it? Because he isn't shocked at all. He's just sort of fascinated from a scientific viewpoint, isn't he?
Mm, yeah.
He's also fascinated with what is going on, although he can't really see that much of it, you know, the spaceship and all the work that they're doing. And he thinks it's the opportunity of a lifetime to study what's going on there. So the Doctor is struggling to get him away, but Rubish refuses. At this point, Lynx arrives and holds the Doctor at gunpoint.
Wonder point.
Yes, toothbrush point, and he guesses that he's the Doctor that people have been talking about. The Doctor starts saying, having spotted the breech-loading rifles that Lynx has made for Iron Grun, he points out to Lynx that he's causing damage to the development of humans, and Lynx basically couldn't care less, could he?
No.
And shoots the Doctor in the face.
Nice.
Apparently, there's a red light has shined on Pertwee's face and he gurns from it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
That is, in CGI, is a bit more impressive than just a red light in his face.
Mm, yeah. The Doctor knows that he's a Sontaran, doesn't he? Lynx confirms that he's a warrior, Sontaran warrior. and all he wants to do is return to his glorious war as soon as possible. But yeah, as you say, the Doctor's then shot in the face. And we're back at Edward's castle with Hal and Sarah. Well, they're talking to Edward and Eleanor. Hal's telling them about the robot and the man from the stars who makes magic weapons. Sarah thinks that the Doctor's behind it all, and it's him that's helping Irongrim. They continue to try to explain what's going on. Hal thinks they're all in danger. But Sarah sort of mentions it must be, you know, she says it must be the Doctor because he's got the time machine and the means to take his scientists back to the past, etc. She says that they must stop him. But the ever ineffective Edward says that there's nothing they can do. She comes back, there's always something you can do. It's just a matter of working out what it is. Hal says to Edward, she has the heart of a lion, sir. I saw her give anger on the sharp edge of her tongue. Quite feisty, isn't she?
She was very feisty, yeah. And they're all a bit surprised, aren't they, in Middle Ages? She suggests that they capture the Doctor, but Sir Edward collapses into ennui again, doesn't he? And Sarah goes nuts and she's saying, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And she suggests a commando raid to get the Doctor using Hal and Sir Edward's other men. You know, Hal's quite happy to get involved, but Sir Edward has been a bit pathetic about it all.
Indeed.
Meanwhile, back in Lynx's workshop, the Doctor is recovering from Lynx's ray. Lynx decided he didn't want to kill him, as his brain will be useful to him.
Hmm.
Lynx starts slagging Earth off as having no military value or strategic significance. And the Doctor, you know, reveals more of his knowledge about the Sontarans, and he talks about their perpetual war with the Rutans, who, of course, we later see in Horror of Fang Rock.
Mm. Sorry, I'll just point out that when the Doctor comes round, he's rubbing his neck, which, of course, is very unusual for John Pertwee.
Yes, we never see him do that, do we, on screen? Interesting sort of parallel here is because we've got a Sontaran story here, which Terence Dix got Robert Holmes to write. Robert Holmes returned the favour when he was script editor and got Terence Dix to write one. This was Horror of Fang Rock, which included the Rutans, and they each gave the other a sort of scenario that they weren't that pleased with, didn't they? Because Terence Dix gave a medieval castle to Robert Holmes, and Robert Holmes gave a Victorian lighthouse to Terence Dix. So these are very much two of a pair, these two stories.
Mm. Yeah, so Doctor mentions this Sontaran-Rutan war that's been going on forever. Lynx says that he was attacked by a squadron of Rutan fighters and forced to make an emergency landing on Earth. The Doctor at this point tells Lynx that he's a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey, which is, of course, the first mention of the name of the Doctor's home planet, isn't it?
It is, yeah, the first mention on screen. Weirdly, in issue 126 of TV Action comic, Barry Letts was answering some questions from Doctor Who fans, you know, readers of TV Action, which had a Doctor Who strip in it.
Yeah.
And one of them asked a question about where the Doctor comes from, and Barry Letts, this is a few months before this was aired, says he comes from Gallifrey. It's actually, in the original Robert Holmes script, it's called Gallifrey.
Mm.
But at some point between there and the screen, it became Gallifrey, which is a slightly more elegant name, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely.
At this point, Lynx recites the Sontaran military assessment of the Time Lords, a race of great technical achievement but lacking the morale to withstand a determined assault.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, is later tried out by the Sontarans in the Invasion of Time during Tom Baker's era.
Indeed.
And then there's a bit of kind of sort of handbags at dawn, isn't there, between Lynx and the Doctor about, you try and take us on, you see what you get.
Yeah, exactly. Lynx says that the Doctor can help him repair his ship, and he then goes on to say that what he did was he adapted his ship's frequency modulator to project himself forward in time. But he only had enough power to get to the 20th century, and that's where he picks up these scientists. The Doctor says he'll help, but only if he returns the scientists to the 20th century. Lynx is angry with that, and he tells him not to attempt to bargain with him. And he gets him to sit in front of this machine. The Doctor's going on about him damaging human evolution again, but Lynx isn't interested. He plonks this device on the Doctor's head, doesn't he? It's kind of like a pair of earphones, although they kind of touch his temples, don't they? It's got a silver ball on the top.
Yes.
And he's underneath this other device that kind of that's above his head as well. Lynx tells him to monitor this panel, and then he flicks a switch behind the Doctor, and he leaves, picking up some of the guns, so he's off to see Irongrim again. But the Doctor tells him that if he gives Iron Grond these guns now, that the human race will probably have nuclear weapons by the 17th century.
As the Doctor's getting riled, saying all this stuff about Link's mucking up human evolution, the machine sparks him, and Link tells him that he would do well to concentrate on the task he's been given.
Mm.
Pertu pulls his fantastic sort of disgruntled granny face. He's just found out someone's nicked one of her mint imperials. And then he starts working, and then you hear Link slam the door on his way out, and the Doctor decides that he'll try and get this headpiece off. He gets sparked again when he touches the headpiece. And he then tries to slide down and try and kind of ease himself out of it that way. And he also gets shocked again there to more sort of a disgruntled granny gurning.
Outside Iron Grond's castle, there's a very tired-looking guard who's quickly overcome by a couple of Edward's men. And Hal and Sarah sort of go inside. Hal's telling Sarah it's not work for women, this, but she says she's the only one that knows the Doctor and kind of leads them on, and Hal smiles to himself at her pluck.
Spunky lady. It's interesting, because the Doctor's pretty distinctive. A brief description would be enough for anyone to work out.
Yeah, like, you know, a long-shanked fellow with a mighty nose.
Yeah, so with a young old face and a beaky nose and all the rest of it. At once lined and smooth and hair black and white and all the other bizarre stuff Tim Sticks used to write.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's not much of an excuse, is it? Because I think a short description would reveal who the Doctor's. But anyway, she's in Lincoln Greens at this point, isn't she? Sarah is one of her many costume changes during this one.
Mm. Yeah, Lynx has presented Iron Grond with these guns. Iron Grond is very pleased, says to Blavax, that they'll march on Sir Edward's castle at dawn. And Sarah and Hal overhear this. They're kind of just outside the window, aren't they, looking in.
Yeah, I assume this is a ground floor window.
Yeah.
but you can't see anything through it. So it gives, throughout, I had the impression it was sort of somewhere fairly high up in the castle.
Yeah, well, maybe they've got one of their ladders.
Yeah, although, a scaling ladder.
Yeah, although that would probably only reach about halfway, wouldn't it? So. More of which later.
Yes.
Back in the workshop, the Doctor's pressing buttons on this machine, but then he spots Rubish. Rubish comes over. And of course, throughout this, Rubish is kind of wandering around half blind, isn't he?
Yeah.
He kind of looks at the Doctor and says, "Are you wearing a hat?" It's dangerous, you know. Overheats the brain. The Doctor points him to the panel behind his back, and he tells him to flick a switch. And of course, Rubish flicks one, but it's the wrong one, and you know the Doctor starts grimacing with pain again, doing his granny impression. But you know, Rubish sort of flicks it back, and then tries another one, and this time it is the right switch, and the Doctor is freed.
Yeah, strangely, he thanks Rubish and shakes his hand, and Rubish manages to shake his hand quite easily, despite not even looking at it and being half blind.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Well, that's a good line, isn't there? But Doctor says he needs to go off and find a young girl. To which Rubish said, "Young girl? I should have thought it was a bit old for that sort of thing."
Yes, excellent. Meanwhile, the Doctor's gone out into one of the corridors of the castle. He bumps into Iron Grond and Bloodaxe. He tries to bluff it out, doesn't he? He says, "Ah, good evening," and shakes at Bloodaxe's hand, who bewilderedly shakes his hand back. And then Perch does his usual, "Hi, chatbot!" sort of a business, and Venusian Aikidos them into a sort of heap in the corridor. And then a stuntman runs into the courtyard wearing a grey wig and starts running around trying to avoid being captured by Iron Grond, Bloodaxe, and about half a dozen of their men. And there's quite a long scene shot from distance, isn't it? Shot from the battlements looking down into the courtyard. And he's running around sort of throwing things at men and dodging them and grabbing their pikes and all sorts. And
oh, funny. I didn't notice that.
Well, you can't see from distance, so. You have to zoom in on that. But
he swings a bucket at them at one point, doesn't he?
Yeah. But eventually he falls over onto a pile of hay, and Iron Grond bears down on him, axe in hand, saying, "He who strikes Iron Grond dies." And episode 2 ends, or part 2, I should say, ends.
Yeah. Yeah, it's another good one.
Mm.
The reprise is a shorter version of that, isn't it?
Yes.
Part 3. And there's a cutaway scene, which we didn't get as well, with Hal and Sarah spotting the Doctor, well, spotting this stuntman being chased around. And Hal shoots an arrow and manages to knock the axe from Angron's grasp, just as about to split the Doctor's skull. If he's that accurate, why didn't he just kill Angron, which is what he wanted to do in the first place?
Yeah, good point. But it's kind of
been over a lot earlier, wouldn't it, if he'd have done that?
It would have been, yeah. But it's a nice moment, it's because it returns the favour when the Doctor shot the control out of Angron's hand, doesn't it?
Oh yeah.
When Hal was about to be killed, so yeah, they're even now, aren't they? The Doctor runs off into the castle, throws some straw down behind him into the corridor and sets fire to it, so Angron and his cronies can't get through. And the Doctor runs up the stairs, up to the battlements, and meets Sarah and Hal up there, and thanks Sarah for a timely rescue. She tells him it isn't a rescue, it's a capture, and two of Shredder's men grab him and drag him away.
Yeah, back in Lynx's workshop, Lynx comes in to find the Doctor gone. Rubish is using a grinder, isn't he, to make himself a kind of a magnifying glass. Angron and Bloodaxe upstairs are drinking some more wine, talking about the Doctor, and Lynx bursts in and he wants Angron to help him look for the Doctor. That's a great line from Angron here. He says, "Bother me now, little toad, you will feel an axe in your skull." then he says, "Is this Doctor a long-shanked rascal with a mighty nose?" Lynx says, "Yeah, that's what it would look like to your primitive eyes."
yes.
Argon tells him that he's been captured by Sir Edward's raiders. Sure enough, back at Sir Edward's castle, Sarah and the Doctor are there, and she accuses him of helping Angron. He tries to convince her it's basically Lynx that's the one that's helping Angron. Tells her that he's an alien from a planet with a gravity many times that of Earth. Sarah's dubious about it, isn't she? He says here that he's working for UNIT, which Sarah seems surprised about, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
And that he was investigating the missing scientists. He says to her, "Have you heard of UNIT?" I think she has, doesn't she? But she doesn't seem to know much about them, even though, you know, they were clearly there. You know, the Brigadier was there with all his men and stuff.
Mm. And surely she knew that he was after, he was looking for the missing scientists already from those opening scenes.
Yeah, it doesn't quite hang together that bit, and the fact that she thinks it's him that's doing it. But I guess she's seen it, you know, she knows he's got a time machine, and I suppose you would put two and two together that he's got the means of doing it, so it probably is him.
There's a nice couple of lines in this scene, aren't there? The Doctor accuses her of being a stowaway, and she says, "Yes, but we'll come to that later." She's quite in control of the situation. The Doctor describes Lynx as nasty, brutish and short, which is actually a line by Thomas Hobbes in his book Leviathan, which is actually about the life of man, not about Sontarans at all.
Well, you know, yes, I don't know what's going to say. Fair enough.
At this point, Sir Edward and Lady Eleanor arrive, and the Doctor sort of charms and smarms them, doesn't he? prompting Sir Edward to call him a courtly rogue. And Sarah admits at this point that she could have been wrong about the Doctor. The Doctor enters a sexist mode again, doesn't he? And says, a generous admission, especially coming from one of the fair sex. so, of course, Sarah blows a fuse at this. Sir Edward then offers the Doctor a choice. He can cast his spells and incantations for him, Sir Edward, against Angron, or he can die. Given his choice, the Doctor predictably agrees to help Sir Edward.
Hal at this point remembers that Angron is going to be attacking their castle at dawn. Edward thinks they're lost. Ever the optimist.
Gives up instantly, doesn't
he? Yeah. But the Doctor says nonsense, and he's got some sort of plan. So back at Angron's castle, Angron and Bloodaxe are getting ready to leave. Lynx arrives, and he wants to come with them, doesn't he? He's interested in seeing the battle. So they go to find him a horse. Unfortunately, we don't get to see Lynx on a horse, do we? But
We don't see him on a scaling ladder either, do we? It's a great line, isn't it, from Angron. Says, "Oh, Bloodaxe, on my oath, can you see that on a scaling ladder?" And they think it's going to be a real pushover, don't they, at Sir Edward's castle? I mean, perhaps they've met Sir Edward.
Yeah. And they know that he's only got 10 men, I suppose.
Yes.
Most of them are old. So, yeah. Back at Edward's castle, Sarah comes into a room with a kind of a dummy soldier. There's a wooden frame, and on the top there's a helmet with a kind of a face painted on, isn't there? And the Doctor is sitting at a table, he's kind of making stink bombs, isn't he?
Yes.
He says he's glad he let her stay.
Yeah.
Yeah, which Sarah's put out at. And she's saying that she gave him a hand with painting these faces, and the Doctor says he's never been a particularly good artist, and he says he at some point he might go and learn with one of the greats, like Rembrandt.
Yeah.
And brings Sarah around to talk about the TARDIS again and ask him if he can go anywhere in the TARDIS. Why doesn't he just go somewhere else that's safer? He says, well, because the human species is at stake and he's got a job to do. Sarah realises from this line that he's not human, and he tells her that he's a Time Lord. Says a bit about the Time Lords and things. They're a bit like galactic ticket inspectors.
Yes.
To which Sarah's response is to kind of look amazed and to say, oh, I could murder a cup of tea.
Yeah, that's a great, great moment. The Doctor's mixing sulphur, saltpeter and fat with a few extras thrown in, and he's putting these little sacks that other people in the castle have made. Then a horn sounds in the distance, and the Doctor gets really excited, doesn't he, about the coming battle, which is not really a star, but I suppose he knows that there isn't going to be any bloodshed.
Yes.
And sure enough, Eirongrin and his men have rode up to Sir Edward's castle, but they're instantly dismayed at the amount of men that appear to be on the battlements. Eirongrin basically decides to retreat, doesn't he?
Yes.
Instantly. But Lynx is saying, oh yeah, but the greater the risk, the greater the glory. And then he reminds them of their rifles.
Yeah, Eirongrin laughs at this, as he laughs at everything, doesn't he? He says, when I'm king, you'll be my champion. He slaps Lynx on the back. I love Lynx's reaction. He kind of like, doesn't take kindly to being slapped on the back, does he? Like,
no, he doesn't. Maybe it's a bit too near his probic vent.
Could be. Up on the battlements, Edward's men are waiting, and we see Sarah and the Doctor wondering why Lynx is there.
The Doctor says Lynx is there because he's like a little boy stirring up the red ants and the black ants. You know, it's just a bit of amusement for him.
Mm. Yeah, Eirongrin shoots at one of these people on the battlements, and he misses. He throws the rifle to the floor, saying it's useless. And Lynx says, well, you know, you don't shoot straight. So he picks it up. He shoots and basically hits one of the dummies, but it doesn't move. It just kind of, you know, absorbs the impact. And basically Lynx says, you know, they're dummies. And Eirongrin says, I smell that fox of a doctor behind this.
It's a shame that Lynx, because there are a few real men up there, isn't it? It's a shame that Lynx didn't hit one of the real ones, then the illusion would have lasted a bit longer.
Yeah.
Not so much fun for the bloke that got hit.
Not particularly, no. And Eirongrin calls for the scaling ladders, doesn't he? And his men rush at the castle with these pair of piddly little ladders, shouting a lot.
Roaring pointlessly.
Lynx kind of just sort of stands watching them. And then the Doctor and Sarah start throwing, you know, the doctor's bombs that he's put together over the wall. Sort of nonchalantly throws them over his shoulder, doesn't he?
Whistling.
Yeah, and they explode in sort of kind of a shower of sparks, and then you get these thick clouds of smoke, don't you? And eventually Eirongrin and his men retreat.
There's one bit, though, there's one of Eirongrin's men is standing there, and this bomb goes off right behind him. It's a massive yellow smoke. Nearly blows his helmet off. Which is quite painful.
Yeah.
You think we'd wear a codpiece?
Yes. So Eirongrin kind of leads the retreat, doesn't he? An arrow hits a tree right next to him where he's kind of stopped to wave on his men. Yeah, and they basically leg it, don't they? Just before the Doctor and Sarah go back inside, up on the battlements, and they're talking about these bombs, Sarah asks if they're gas. The Doctor says, no, it's just a superior type of stink bomb with a few bangs and flashes thrown in. He says it's basically harmless, but it gives off a bit of a whiff, and he sniffs the air, doesn't he? And makes a face, and they go back inside.
Yes. Back at Eirongrin's castle, they've arrived back, and Eirongrin's furious again. And he turns to the men and goes, oh, mice!
Absolutely brilliant.
Superb. With poltroons like these, it were ill work to lay siege to a hen coop.
He's basically accusing them of like legging it, doesn't he? Whereas, as Lynx is about to point out, it was him that was leading the way.
It was, but he decides they're going to attack the following day, doesn't he?
Mm.
Lynx storms in, doesn't he? Helmet off, to the horror of Eirongrin's men who hadn't seen him like that before. And they have a real bicker, don't they, him and Eirongrin, about Eirongrin leading the retreat and about Lynx not doing anything.
Mm.
Lynx claims he's there just to observe. They actually come to blows, don't they? And Lynx knocks Eirongrin over pretty easily onto this long-suffering table, calls them childish, squabbling primitives and storms off.
Yeah. Eirongrin says to him, taunt me not, little toad face. He starts calling him a toad now, doesn't he?
Yes.
Quite a lot. That's sort of thing. That's the first reference to it. So Lynx storms out. Back at Sir Edward's castle, they're having a feast to celebrate the fact that he got a temporary respite from Iron Grom. The Doctor has some wine, doesn't he? Mm. Cheeky devil.
He doesn't spit it out and complain it's not like the gums.
No. Edward thanks the Doctor for his part in their victory, but they realise, as I said, that it's only temporary. The Doctor says that the only way to stop Iron Grom capturing their castle is basically to capture his, to everybody's amazement. And he hands Eleanor a list of herbs and simples, which he wants her to brew up a little draught.
Yes, to calm Iron Grin down a little.
Mm.
Which is necessary as we go back to Iron Grin, who's cursing, he's sat there with Bloodaxe cursing Lynx. Bloodaxe is wondering why he didn't kill Lynx, as he keeps saying he should have done. And Iron Grin's a little taken aback at this, isn't he? And then Bluff said it was a strategic decision, as he still needs Lynx's weapons, and when he has them, he will then kill Lynx. Bloodaxe, as usual, is really impressed, isn't he, by Iron Grin? Oh, it is a cunning plan. Baldric style from Blackadder.
Yeah.
And then there's this really strange moment, isn't there, where Bloodaxe says to Iron Grin, yours is indeed a towering intelligence. And then Iron Grin looks sort of confused and slightly angry about the remark.
Well, he looks at him a bit suspiciously because he thinks he's taking a piss, doesn't he?
Basically. Yeah, is that what it is?
Yeah, I think so. That's what how I read it anyway.
Yeah, I think so. Right. Yeah, he does look with great suspicion at
him. Yeah. Yeah.
Towering intelligence is not the kind of phrase that Bloodaxe normally comes out with.
Yeah, it's a good line. But then we see the Doctor and Sarah dressed as a couple of monks. And they approach the castle gates, Iron Grom's castle gates, where there are a couple of guards. The Doctor putting on a silly voice. It's almost his Wurzel Gummidge voice, isn't it?
It is, very similar.
And he's basically begging alms from Iron Grom, and he's heard that that Iron Grom's famous for his charity. And the reason you were laughing as I started this bit is because the guard response goes down in Doctor Who history as one of the worst delivered lines ever. The guard says that Iron Grom is indeed kindly and charitable and kind of waves them in. But as they walk past, he turns to his mate and he says, it is to be hoped the friars are fleet of foot or the church will have two new martyrs ere long. And then laughs ridiculously.
There's a terrible pause in there between his punchline and this uproarious laugh, far greater than the joke deserved.
Old friar, what business have you here?
We come to beg alms of the good Captain Iron Grom. Fame of his charity is spread far and wide.
You will find Captain Iron Grom in the Great Hall. He is indeed a kindly and charitable man, and his temper is most sweet and pleasant. Prosper.
Heaven will reward you, my son. Come, brother.
It is to be hoped the two friars are fleet of foot, or the church will have two new martyrs ere long.
Brilliant. Oh, that's brilliant. Absolutely superb moment.
Mm.
Anyway, the Doctor and Sarah get to Lynx's workshop and take off their monk's robes. And Sarah is once again has had a costume change, now dressed as a medieval serving wench. She sees Lynx's ship and the hypnotized scientist, and the Doctor explains what's going on, and Rubish appears. The Doctor's noticed that the ship will soon be ready for takeoff, and Rubish is saying that Lynx has been working the scientists at a killing pace, and shows them a scientist who's sort of passed out under a table through starvation and overwork. Sarah's saying, well, shouldn't we get some food and drink? And the Doctor says, there isn't really time. Plus, if Lynx takes off, everyone in the castle will die. So that is the greater priority.
Mm-hmm. Lynx, meanwhile, we saw him when the Doctor and Sarah were coming in. He went past with a crate, didn't he?
Mm.
And he drops this crate onto Iron Grom's table and tells him it's the weapons that he's promised him. And Iron Grom says, thanks, good Toadface, good Lynx. Lynx says if he's got time, he'll repair the robot for him as he'd promised before he leaves. Iron Grom says that he can't leave until Iron Grom says he can. And he says, you know, you'll need my men to get your ship outside again. And Lynx says, well, you clearly don't understand anything about space travel. You know, I'll leave when I'm ready, and it would be foolish of you to attempt to stop me. He exits the room.
Yes. Meanwhile, the doctor in Lynx's workshop is trying to break the hypnosis on one of the scientists, and he's flashing a pen torch in a rhythm into the scientist's eyes. Meanwhile, Rubish is sort of, you know, having been on a starvation diet, is dreaming of returning to the 20th century for steak, mushrooms, lobster, chocolate truffles. But the doctor plans to get everyone back there using Lynx's osmic projector. But he has to get them out of hypnosis first because it's too risky to send them over in that state, apparently. He discovers that the polka time rhythm starts to break the hypnosis. But at this point, Lynx arrives.
He does, and he comes in and takes off his helmet. He notices the scientist lying on the floor, and he uses his magic wand on one of them, tells him to get back to work, but there's no response from him because he's obviously exhausted. And he says that if he doesn't get up, he'll kill him, at which point the doctor comes out from hiding and tells him to stop. Lynx is very pleased that the doctor's there because, you know, his one regret about leaving was that he didn't get a chance to kill the doctor. The doctor basically offers his help at this point if Lynx agrees to help to dehypnotize these scientists, send them home, and also to capture Iron-Gron and his men, and then, you know, he can take off destroying the castle and all the weapons in it. He doesn't want much, really, does the doctor?
No, it's a fairly even sort of bargain.
Yeah, he offers to help him when he's basically literally finished what he's doing anyway.
Yes.
And he wants all of this in return.
He wants the moon on a stick.
He does. Anyway, Lynx kind of listens to all of this, and then he says, "So you want my answer, do you?" The doctor says, "Yes," and he just raises his wand and shoots him in the face again, and the episode ends.
Yeah, interestingly, the musical scream at the beginning of the closing music, it seems to come in a little too early, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
It comes in before Lynx has even raised his weapons.
Yeah.
I think we can see what's coming anyway. Into part four, and it must be one of the shortest reprises in Doctor Who history, mustn't it?
Because yeah.
It just starts with Lynx saying, "Here is my answer," doesn't it? And shooting the Doctor. So it's probably a pretty long episode, this one. No room for a longer reprise. Sarah jumps up and sort of pushes Lynx's arm away mid-shot, you know, just to save the Doctor. But basically she falls to the floor and Lynx has them both at gunpoint. A scientist collapses in another part of the room, and the Doctor tells Lynx that they basically can't go on without any food or rest. Meanwhile, Rubish is creeping around behind Lynx. At this point, he's got this little spyglass he's made, hasn't he? This little sort of lorgnette that he can look through. Meanwhile, Lynx and the Doctor are sort of arguing about their own race's philosophies, and Lynx is saying the Time Lord philosophy is egalitarian twaddle and is a weakness, and which gives the opportunity to start talking about each race having their own weakness, and the Sontarans being the probic vent, the small hole at the back of their necks. Of course, this is exactly what Rubish needs, and just as Lynx decides he's going to kill Sarah in front of the Doctor and then kill the Doctor, Rubish whacks Lynx on the probic vent with a big stick. He collapses. Yeah,
yeah, with a kind of a strangled hiss, doesn't he?
Yes, obviously quite painful.
Yeah. The Doctor thanks Sarah for interrupting Lynx's blast. Rubish brings some rope over, doesn't he? And they start to tie Lynx up. Upstairs, Iron-Gron is examining the guns, and he asks Blood Axe to go and fetch Lynx for him again. The Doctor's tied him up, Lynx, when Blood Axe arrives, and he calls through the door for him. And the Doctor basically puts Lynx's helmet over his head to disguise his voice a bit and pretends to be Lynx, and he basically tells Blood Axe he's busy and to go away, which Blood Axe does.
Yeah, it's the first time Lynx has a lisp, isn't it? At this moment, but Blood Axe doesn't seem to notice. Blood Axe's relationship with Lynx is really good, isn't it? He's very, very wary of him.
Yeah.
And quite scared of him as well. And he's often sent up there, isn't he, to try and get him. And he's very unconvincing, isn't he? Yeah, come soon, or we'll come and get you. And then runs off.
Yeah. The Doctor leaves Rubish behind to revive the scientists. He shows him what to do. The Doctor wants to use Lynx's osmic projector to send the scientist back. But first he needs to go and stall Iron-Gron. Quite sure why. Presumably just from coming back into the room. I'm not exactly sure what he wants to stall him for.
Well, Blood Axe says that they'll come and get Lynx if he doesn't come soon. So I suppose he wants to stop them, come back to the room, as you say, while Rubish is reviving the scientist.
I guess. Anyway, he spots the robot, and that gives him an idea.
Meanwhile, Sarah's arrived at the kitchens. She starts taking some food, presumably for the scientists starving in the dungeon, but is caught by Meg, the cliched cook stroke serving Winston. She, brilliantly, she tries to bluff her way out of it, doesn't she, Sarah, pretending she's a lady, telling this scullion to unhand her. But Meg notices she's wearing a serving winch's outfit, so that doesn't really work. Sarah then brilliantly turns the whole thing on her head and then pretends to be some sort of starving urchin, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Meg says that, yes, she can have some bread and cheese, but she'll have to earn it.
Then, up in the Great Hall, the Doctor enters dressed as the robot. And speaking in a kind of a robotic voice, he tells Iron that it's a gift from Lynx. And he says that Lynx is working on more such robots, which is why he's not come himself. But it all goes terribly wrong, doesn't it? Because Sargon wants to, he wants to see this robot in action. He wants it to fight against him. The Doctor tries to protest, saying that, you know, he was made to fight for Sargon, not against him. But Sargon's not having any of it, and he draws his sword and starts to attack. And then there's this kind of sword fight, fairly brief sword fight, which the Doctor wins quite easily. But Argron then asks Bloodaxe to join him, and the two of them start fighting against the robot, or the robot doctor.
Yes, a bit unfair. Meanwhile, in the kitchens, Meg is wandering around hitting the staff.
Yeah.
I think she probably gives Bella Emberg a swipe at some point. But Sarah's wondering what all the noise is in the Great Hall above. Meg basically says, oh, they're brawling, you know, mucking about like kids up there, and tells Sarah to get back to work. She's very suspicious of Sarah, isn't she? You see her kind of watching her. But at the moment, you know, Sarah's okay, and she just carries on. Back up in the Great Hall, Iron Grin's, or down in the Great Hall, if people can look through the windows, I suppose. But in the Great Hall, Iron Grin calls a halt to their sort of two against one fight, and decides that they'll slow the robot down a bit with a couple of crossbow bolts in its gizzard. And if that fails, they'll lop its head off. Of course, at this point, the doctor gets a bit of a brown trousers moment, brown adrenaline. And for some reason, puts on this kind of Toff's voice, doesn't he?
Said, yeah.
Isn't that a bit unsporting, old man? Sitting ducks and all that. to which Iron Grin is sort of astonished, and he says, this Iron Man talks like some Norman ninny. he goes over and lifts up the visor and sees that it's a doctor underneath, and the doctor tries to run away, but is caught and dragged back. And there's another piece of good direction. The same thing happened when they brought Hal into the Great Hall, and Iron Grin, you know, was about to chop his head off. The camera sort of goes around behind, in this case, the Doctor and the men that are holding him, and so you can see Iron Grin over the Doctor's shoulders. It's quite nice. And he takes the Doctor's helmet off and is about to chop his head off, basically, with his sword. But then, in true sort of Bond villain style, decides that that's too quick and clean a death for him. As he is a wizard, he shall die by wizardry.
Downstairs in the kitchen, Sarah's asking if the stew is for Igron's men. Meg says it is, but it wouldn't be for the sort of the guards outside. They would eat the oatmeal, so she figures out that if she's going to poison anything, it needs to be both the stew and the oatmeal.
Meg says that the guards are lusty enough on the oatmeal without having stew into the bargain, and she says that Sarah should watch herself if she needs to take the skillet out there. Sarah says she's not afraid of men. And basically tries to start a feminist movement in this Middle Ages kitchen. She gets nowhere, basically. She's trying to say that, you know, why should women obey what men do? You know, why should they be subservient? And Meg just says that's just the way it is. You should put up with it. And Sarah quite accurately tells her she's still living in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
Of course she is.
Yeah. She realises how stupid the remark is.
Yeah, and Meg obviously doesn't understand it because that term is meaningless at that time. Meg wanders off, and Sarah slips some green powder or liquid, it's something that the doctor's made up from these herbs and simples. She slips some into the stew that she's sort of stirring, then distracts one of the other kitchen staff by saying there's a spider close by, and as the woman sort of shrieks and runs off, she pours some of this green stuff into the oatmeal, so that means everyone's going to cop some of it.
Downstairs, or wherever it is, Rubish is singing to himself and reviving the scientists. Basically, most of them are revived at this point, aren't they? And he starts telling them that they're about to be sent home. But, you know, until they're ready. They'll have to carry on pretending as if they were hypnotized. Mm. And they hear Iron Grun calling Lynx's name. And so they kind of all go back to pretending to work. Iron Grun comes in and he finds Lynx tied up. He basically cuts his bonds and pulls him to his feet. And Lynx, you know, asks where the doctor is. Iron Grun says, you know, he's upstairs, he's dying. The thing I thought about this was, how long has he been awake? And because he's awake when Iron Grun goes over to him, isn't he? So surely he would have been heard what Rubish had been saying.
Oh, that's true.
But he seems oblivious to Rubish throughout, doesn't he?
Yeah, Rubish is almost invisible, isn't it, to Lynx. He wanders around and does what he likes, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he's not hypnotized, so you know he can sort of observe as much as he can do with very little vision. But yeah, I mean, Lynx appears not even to notice he exists. Apparently, he can't hear him either.
No. Weird.
But at this point, when David Acre wrenches Kevin Lindsay as Lynx up into a standing position, the Sontaran mask is almost out of the collar, isn't it?
Mm.
So Lynx has a sort of chin poking out above the collar, which you don't normally see.
Yeah.
It must be quite a long mask, actually, because it comes up quite a long way without revealing any, you know, human underneath.
Mm. Back upstairs, Iron Grun and Lynx, and Iron Grun's men as well, they hand the doctor back his jacket, don't they? And, but then Iron Grun says he's going to give his men some target practice, and they're all basically lined up with guns. And he says, these knaves aim so well, you may have better to stay still. And they basically start shooting at him, don't they? The doctor kind of dodges as the men shoot these rifles, basically missing him, funnily enough. Downstairs, Sarah hears the shots, doesn't she? And Meg tells her what's going on. And, you know, Sarah's obviously worried and manages to rush out of the room while Meg's distracted talking to one of the other women. There's a great line from Argon here, isn't there? It says, by the stars, this fellow hops around like a flea on a griddle.
Yeah, they have a little joke, don't they, the Doctor and Iron Grun, because he's basically saying, yeah, I'll be patient, Doctor, you know, we'll get you in the end. And the Doctor says, oh, don't worry, I'm in no hurry. And,
yeah.
And Iron Grun's saying, oh yeah, I'm beginning to grow fond of him.
Yeah. But Lynx is, you know, he's had enough and he asks for a weapon. You know, he says, oh, you know, I'll basically kill him. But, you know, Iron Grun thinks they're having fun. So he doesn't do that. Sarah arrives on the floor above, doesn't she? You see her come out onto the kind of balcony bit above the room. She manages to swing a chandelier towards the doctor, who's kind of rushed up onto these stairs to try and, you know, avoid being shot. And she swings it towards him, and he grabs it, swings across the room, past all of Iron Grun's men and everybody, and out the door, which he bars behind him straight away. It's quite a good little getaway, I think.
Yeah, it's brilliant. The Doctor and Sarah then reach the gates, and the two imbecilic guards we saw earlier are easily tricked by the Doctor, aren't they? Just kind of looks like he's going to show them some sort of trick, and they come close, and eventually sort of hits them both in the throat with some sort of Venusian Aikido, presumably, and they escape. And we then see them eating at Sir Edward's castle, and during the conversation the Doctor reveals he's over 200.
Yeah, not a lad anymore.
No, indeed not. And of course, there's a stunned silence when he says that. But then they carry on talking. But the Doctor, Sarah, and Hal decide that they're going to wait for the potion to work, and then they're going to go back and rescue the scientists because they know that the ship's going to take off and the cars will explode fairly soon.
Mm.
So that is the plan.
Indeed, it is. Back in the workshop, Lynx is starting his spaceship engines. You hear this build up of power, don't you? He tells the scientists that their work's done. He tells them they can go and rest, and he leaves the room. And then we see the Doctor coming out of the TARDIS, and he's got some strange sort of metal fan, hasn't he?
Yeah, it winds out to a sort of full circle, reflective surface, isn't it?
Mm. And he joins Sarah and Hal. They're looking over at the castle, and they watch from afar as the two stupid guards fall unconscious. And then we see them arriving in the workshop where they find Rubish. The Doctor asks Hal to go and check Argron's men, make sure they're asleep and to disarm them all. So he goes off to do that. The Doctor goes into Lynx's ship to go and get the osmic projector. He tells them they've got about 5 or 10 minutes before, you know, the whole castle's going to be blown to kingdom come. We see Hal in the corridor, don't we, removing one of the swords from a sleeping man.
Yes, so the Doctor gets the osmic projector out of Lynx's spaceship, but the drive system is sealed, so he can't actually shut the ship down. The Doctor starts sending the scientists back one by one using the osmic projector, and he shows Rubish how to do it. Meanwhile, in the Great Hall, Irongrin and his men are feasting and roistering, aren't they? Lynx is standing there, sort of watching and not joining in. And he again tells them he's going to leave, and that they should also leave the castle and find another, because he knows what's going to happen to it. Mm. They don't take him at all seriously, do they? And eventually, Lynx sort of struts out moodily, doesn't he?
Mm. He says, by dawn, I'll be 700 million miles from here.
Yes, that's right. And they all laugh about this because they're all a bit drunk, aren't they, by now? And Irongrin is saying, he is a toad who knows what a toad thinks. Or roars of laughter.
Yeah.
And then seconds after roaring with laughter, they all fall asleep, don't they?
They do indeed.
Very, very quickly.
Yeah. Lynx comes back into the workshop and the Doctor uses his metal fan to block, you know, Lynx's weapon when he tries to shoot at him. Lynx tries to get a better angle and tries again, but the Doctor does the same thing, and then eventually Lynx knocks it out of his hands. But at the same time, the Doctor kind of kicks Lynx's weapon away as well, and his helmet, and knocks his helmet to the floor, and they kind of have a bit of a grapple. Sarah and Rubish are continuing to send the scientists home, and Hal, meanwhile, is continuing to disarm Irongrin's men in the main room.
It's strange, isn't it? He just takes a sword and puts them on the floor, doesn't he? He's scripted to chuck them out the window, but he doesn't. It just doesn't seem that disarmed, you know. They're all sort of pretty much within reach, aren't they, swords?
In fact, they're probably, you know, it's probably easier. You don't even have to take it out of your scabbard. You just need to put your hand
it all at one place. Just pick one up as you leave the room.
Weird. But as he's wandering around disarming them all, Irongrin awakes, doesn't he? And he grabs Hal and pushes him roughly to the floor, knocking him out, actually, isn't he? And he's crying about treachery, and he thinks Lynx has betrayed him, doesn't he? And he rushes out of the room, heading down towards the workshop.
Yes, where Lynx is fighting the Doctor, or at least Terry Walsh in a wig. Stuntman. And Sarah takes the osmic projector and sends Rubish back. Lynx hurls the Doctor over during this continuing fight, and then Irongrin appears at the door and is about to slice Lynx in two with his broadsword, but Lynx shoots him. And that's the end of Irongrin.
Mm.
And Lynx rushes into his ship. Meanwhile, in the Great Hall, Hal wakes up, shakes Bloodaxe awake, and tells him to flee the castle as it's about to be destroyed by sorcery. Mm-hmm. And eventually Bloodaxe sort of comes to, wakes the others, and they all flee the room. Quite comically, actually.
Yeah. Flee, dogs! Flee the alive! Yes. That was a bit I was thinking about with that rubbish member of Irongrin's men who basically just does a comedy bit of acting, trying to get, you know, waving his arms in the air and looking around and going out. You know, it's just like, it's absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Lynx, when he shoots Irongrin, he kind of turns to then shoot the Doctor, but the noise of the ship changes, doesn't it? And he obviously realizes he has to go inside now, so that's why he doesn't kill him.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Anyway, Sarah's trying to wake up the unconscious Doctor when Hal arrives, and inside, Lynx is at the controls of his ship, and the door starts to close. But Hal gets there just in time, and he looses an arrow and gets him right in the probic vent.
Oh, painful.
Yes, Lynx slumps over controls, but as a last action, he hits a big button on the control panel, and things start to go a bit mad, don't they?
Yes, the Doctor senses that something's gone wrong. Lynx has probably hit the takeoff button too soon, and they probably have about a minute to get out. Lynx's ship starts to glow red, and the equipment in the workshop starts to blow up. And the Doctor and Sarah and Hal escape the castle. You see them running through this courtyard, and just as they get out of the courtyard, a quarry is blown up.
Yeah, I don't know why they cut to that, really. I'd much rather seen the castle exploding, but for some reason they showed us this quarry. I'm not really sure where that fitted in.
I think it's a section of Hand of Fear that had been pre-filmed.
Could well be.
Yeah, what happened is here, the director rather lazily used some stock footage of a quarry blowing up. it's almost subliminal, isn't it? There's a kind of a split second, but you can see that it's, you know, before the explosion, but you can see that it's a quarry that's blowing up and not a castle. Mm. Barry Letts had told him that, you know, use a model and blow that up, because that was very successful when they did it in The Demons, when they blew the church up, so much so that people wrote in and complained that they blew up a church for a TV program. But, once again, Alan Bromley said, no, it'll be fine. And it wasn't. And again, Barry Letts wasn't pleased with the result. No. And he never directed for Barry Letts again, did he? The only other time he directed for Doctor Who again was Nightmare of Eden, when, of course, that would have been Graham Williams in charge then, isn't it?
Yeah. But the Doctor, Sarah and Hal are basically thrown to the floor by this blast. And you see the kind of flash of white light, don't you? And they kind of pick themselves up, brush the leaves off their clothes, and amazingly, they're right next to the TARDIS. The Doctor tells Hal that he can tell Sir Edward his troubles are all over. And then he and Sarah say their goodbyes, and they go inside the TARDIS, and it dematerialises, much to Hal's amazement. And the episode ends.
That's the end of the Time Warrior. Mm. A quick word on ratings. I know how you love them. Part 1, 8.7 million viewers. Part 2, 7 million. Part 3, 6.6 million. But part 4, way back, well, up and further to 10.6 million.
Mm, interesting.
As usual, I mean, a rating for an episode more depends on the episode before, doesn't it, than the episode itself. So I don't know how much you can deduce from these, except that people seem to like part 3, I suppose.
Yeah, but there is something interesting about this, actually, that apparently the episode 1 was brought forward by a couple of weeks. It was initially supposed to start after Christmas, but they brought it forward to before Christmas. And apparently that people were quite surprised about that, so I don't know if that had any impact on the
viewing
figures. Because, of course, this spanned the Christmas New Year period. So could just be coincidental, but I don't know.
Well, that's our usual in-depth analysis of the rating. So what did you make of Time Warrior, Martin?
I loved it. Thought it was really, really good. It's one of those stories that I never really think of as, kind of the top echelons of Doctor Who stories, but I think it deserves a place there, really. I think it's a really cracking story with a brilliant monster, really well portrayed by Kevin Lindsay. He really gives Lynx a really good character and basically defines the Sontarans for us, doesn't he? And I think it's got another really strong character in Arngrun. David Dacre's performance as Arngrun is superb. Robert Holmes has always got a kind of a double act in his stories, and they are the double act in this, aren't they?
Well, there's two double acts, because you get Arngrun and Buddocks exchange quite a lot of good dialogue, don't they?
You do, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, he's double up on his double acts.
Exactly. I think it's probably one of Robert Holmes' funniest scripts as well. The lines are really good. Some of the sort of insults that Arngrun throws at everybody, and it's great.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking it's almost a comedy, isn't it? The Time Warrior, almost. There is enough sort of action and excitement in it for it not to be a straight comedy, but there is a light-hearted air about it without it being silly, which the show found more difficult later down the line to pull off that one, didn't it? Particularly in the Graham Williams era. But there is so much funny stuff in it, and there is there's a slight satirical edge to Portrayal of the Sontarans, isn't it? It's very sort of anti-war stuff, isn't it, from Robert Holmes, you know, he's making fun of these sort of Colonel Blimp, sort of bellicose, warmongery types.
Mm.
And the same applies, I guess, a bit to Arngrun as well. And you see that again in The Two Doctors when Robert Holmes writes for the Sontarans again, where it becomes, tips over the edge and just becomes silly, I think. But actually, the most menacing portrayal of the Sontarans is Bob Baker and Dave Martin's Sontaran Experiment, which is, again, Kevin Lindsay.
Yeah.
But that's a lot bleaker and more serious, isn't it, than this?
Mm.
But notwithstanding the level of humour, it's still an exciting plot, and, you know, the reveal of Lynx is pretty darn scary. It scared the life out of me as a kid.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just the right side of full-on comedy, but just brilliant script, isn't it? Cracking dialogue throughout from pretty much all the characters, really.
Yeah, I mean, the comedy bits, like Sam, I wouldn't call it a comedy. It's got funny lines in it, but the story itself is played straight. You've got the bit of the two guards, which is just ridiculous. But what happens in the story isn't particularly funny. It's just what people are saying that's what makes it funny.
Yeah, but I mean, some of the bits with, you know, the Doctor darting around being shot at, and, you know, the stuff with the robot knight and stuff is fairly comedic, perhaps not always intentionally. Mm. Yeah, as I say, it's not full-on comedy, but it's a very strong seam of comedy throughout, I think. But not to its detriment at all. In fact, it makes it a better story than if it had been entirely po-faced throughout.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit different for that reason to a lot of the John Pertwee era, which, you know, was pretty serious, wasn't it? And the Doctor had lost a lot of his sort of whimsicality, which he regains a little bit in this story, I thought.
Yeah.
He seems a happier Doctor, doesn't he? And I think John Pertwee seems quite happy in the role in this one. Perhaps it's because it was filmed so closely after the Green Death and all that stuff about the UNIT family splitting up and really kind of sunk into John Pertwee, because that's the reason he left in the end, isn't it? Because Katie Manning had gone and Roger Delgado was dead, and he died soon after this was screened, I think, didn't he? So I think we get a very likeable third Doctor in this one, which wasn't always the case.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, he didn't annoy me like he can in some of the stories at all. In fact, I thought he was, you know, there wasn't any of that kind of smugness and condescending type of behaviour that you can get from John Pertwee.
Yeah, there was a bit of slightly out of character sexism, wasn't there?
Yeah, but even that was, it didn't jar, which, you know, sometimes it can. I'm watching a Pertwee story, I just, you know, just think, oh, shut up. But I didn't feel that at all with this. I really liked him, you know, and the story, I think it's great.
Yeah, it's a very good performance. The plot was great, I think.
There's a few holes in it.
Yeah, but the basic idea of a, you know, a stranded alien in the Middle Ages is brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the basic premise and the majority of it is very well thought out. But there are, you know, why did Lynx go to 20th century England to get these scientists? When he got back there, he just brainwashes them and tells them what to do anyway, so surely he could have done that with anybody.
Well, that's the point. I suppose the 20th century is as far as he could get, wasn't it, with the Osmium projector. And presumably brains that are used to thinking about complicated stuff are better than just medieval brains, I don't know.
Yeah.
It creates a link with, you know, the Doctor wasn't Earthbound at that point, but, you know, his stories were still very much Earth-based.
Yeah,
And it provides that link, doesn't it? And I think that's another nice aspect of the story, you know, these scientists being plucked out to help him rebuild his spaceship. And it's a nice kind of resolution, isn't it? It's tidy, isn't it, that the castle blows up and all the alien and future artifacts are blown up in the style of The Visitation. And, yeah. And it was a good death, I think, for Lynx to die by the sword. You know, the great warrior dying by the sword, or arrow, as it turns out. But
yeah.
He died in a kind of combat situation, which is probably what he would have wanted. I don't know that Hal was aware that the probing event was a weak point, because it wasn't said in front of him, but it was a good shot. Had he shot him just straight in the back, it probably wouldn't have killed him.
No, definitely. Yeah, I think it was a good ending for Lynx. Arngron's was a bit disappointing. I'd rather not have seen Lynx kill him. You know, it was a bit too easy in the end. It would have been nicer to find a better resolution for Arngron, but probably the only thing I was a little bit disappointed about.
He deserved a better death than that, I think.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. The other thing that doesn't really make a lot of sense is, you know, where did Lynx get these guns from? Because they're, you know, they're Earth-type weapons, but not from the 20th century or from the current time. Where did he get them from?
Where did he get the design from, I suppose? I mean, he's making them, isn't he?
But how? Has he got, like, somewhere where he can kind of smelt iron and stuff?
Yeah, that's a bit odd. And where does he get the design? Or has he got a deep knowledge of Earth weaponry through the ages? That is a strange one, yeah.
Yeah, and you would think that if he's going to give them weapons, he'd give them Suntaran weapons.
Yeah, but
of some description.
Yeah, I mean, he don't want tooling them up with the state-of-the-art equipment. You know, it makes him rather vulnerable, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess. I didn't quite hang together that bit. But yeah. You know, as ever with these scripts, you can always find holes here and there. But nevertheless, absolutely enjoyable. You know, I watched it two or three times for this podcast. And, you know, for me, it was never a case of, I haven't got to watch it again.
Yeah, it can be the case sometimes. I mean, I've seen the story a lot of times, and I've watched it a couple of times for this podcast, as you say. And, yeah, it's great stuff. On to the rest of the supporting cast, David Dacre was superb. John J. Carney was good fun as Blood X, perhaps not such a great performance, but he was good enough, I think. Alan Rowe as Sir Edward and June Brown as Lady Eleanor were good enough, I suppose. Jeremy Bullock as Hal was okay. Donald Pelmere as Rubish, I thought, was brilliant.
Yeah, he was.
Some of the best lines, doesn't he? And it delivered very well.
Yeah, definitely.
Sheila Fay as Meg was okay. A bit cliche, I suppose. But I'm not sure why she had a dead turkey on her head throughout the story. Good to see Nicholas Courtney for a few minutes.
Yeah.
Towards the beginning. And a special mention has to go to Steve Brunswick as the sentry with the gag. He quite literally never worked again as an actor. So.
I can't believe that.
I know. How horribly overlooked was it?
Yeah. Oh, hilarious. But yeah, pretty good supporting cast, I thought. The only person we haven't spoken about yet is Sarah. Of course, we chose this podcast because of the sad death of Elizabeth Sladen recently, and it's her first appearance as Sarah Jane. What did you think of her?
Well, I think she is brilliant. I think this is also her finest hour in the time era. It's not to say that she got worse as time went on, but I think she's provided with a very strong script, and she's got a lot to do, and she's her character has a chance to bring a lot of personality out into the role. We were toying with doing Hand of Fear, weren't we, because it's just been shown on the BBC as a tribute to her. I think this is a better story for her, despite Hand of Fear being based quite a lot around Sarah Jane Smith and also her last story. But this, I think, is better for her. She's an excellent actress, I think, and I think she is probably the best acted companion in classic Who.
Yeah.
I mean, some excellent acting happens nowadays with the companions, but I think that wasn't always the case in classic Who, but I think Elizabeth Sladen is brilliant.
Yeah, definitely. I think the only one that would give her a run for her money would maybe be William Russell as Ian.
Maybe Louise Jameson as Leela as well, I think, is very good.
Yes.
But I think I still think Elizabeth Sladen is the best. She is very convincing when she's scared.
Mm.
Very convincing. And other actors have said about her, I've forgotten his name, but the chap who played Tommy in the Planet of the Spiders was talking about her, and he said she's a very intense actress, and she was very in the moment. You know, she believed she was Sarah Jane Smith. She really lost herself in the story, and he says he's never seen acting of that much intensity anywhere else other than Helen Mirren, he said. So that's a good company to be in.
Definitely, yeah.
You can see that when her character is supposed to be scared, she looks scared, isn't she?
Convincing. Yeah. Well, she is very convincing, as you say. I totally agree with everything you said. She's an excellent actress and really likeable. And she instantly gets into the role in this story, doesn't she? Like I say, it gives her a lot to do, and she's probably never quite as good again. As you said, it's not that she gets as bad, but what happens with a lot of companions, they start strongly, but as they go on, the writing gets worse, doesn't it? And the writers forget that, you know, they've actually got a character of their own, and they tend to degenerate into screaming idiots. That doesn't really happen for Sarah, I have to say, but it does a little bit, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's excellent in this story, and it's a good one to do as a tribute, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Just a little bit about Kevin Lindsay's Lynx. Has a lot of acting in a helmet to start with, doesn't he? Which can be difficult because you have to rely on movement and body language, don't you? He's very menacing, the way he moves. And that works very well even before you see his terrifying face. Fantastic makeup from John Friedlander on this. And I think this and the Sontaran Experiment are the Sontarans at their best. And unfortunately, they're pretty crappy there on in, aren't they? And especially now.
Yeah, they're dreadful. You know, Invasion of Time and the Two Doctors, they're awful. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, how could you design something first time that's so good and then have it completely messed up? You know, if you're going to change a design, you would think they'd change it for the better, but they don't at all, do they?
No, it's diminishing returns, isn't it, with the Sontarans, unfortunately. Mm. So this is their finest moment as a result of that. The other costumes I thought were... I mean, the costume for Lynx is great and much better than these sort of blue things that these children wear when they portray Sontarans these days. So great costume there, but elsewhere the costumes are excellent, aren't they? The only problem I'd say is the robot knight looks a bit weird, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Doesn't look very menacing.
Yeah, that's probably the only thing that isn't very good, really. When he operates it, what it does is it just like waves its sword up and down, you know.
Yeah, it's not a great fight.
No.
It's like a war machine. It's got about as much variety of movement as a war machine from William Hartnell's era.
Yeah, that's true. The use of the location, the castle, for the location shooting was excellent.
Yeah.
It's really adds to the story, I think. You know, the interior sets as well are very good, I think.
Yeah, and I think stone walls are always a problem, aren't they, in studios? It's very hard to make them look convincing. But I think they did very well, and the sets are dressed very well. No complaints there. And I said Sir Edward's Great Hall is perhaps the best interior set that we see.
Mm.
It's really good. The Peckforton Castle setting, as you say, was great, and particularly because it's such a well-preserved Middle Ages castle, isn't it? The problem with programmes like Robin of Sherwood is they try and use castles from the era, but of course they're far too old and ruined for the era that the stories are set in.
Mm.
Whereas they find a nice preserved one here, and it works very well indeed.
It does, really good.
Just a word on Alan Bromley's direction. We've said it's a couple of howlers, aren't there? Some effects that he thought he could pull off, but didn't. But other than that, I think he does a good job.
Yeah, I think he's, you know, there's nothing wrong with the direction at all. I think it's pretty solid.
Yeah, there's some nice movement of cameras in Irongrin's Great Hall, as I mentioned before, you know, coming in round behind the people he's captured. He pulls actually twice, and it works well on both occasions.
Yeah.
Nice use of long shots, you know, shooting stuff into the courtyard from the battlements.
Yeah, that's really good, really effective.
Works well. It gives him a nice feeling of space and slightly more epic quality than we're used to sometimes with Doctor Who. And for a very low budget, the attack on Sir Edward's castle is okay, I think, although they say the scaling ladders could be a bit more impressive.
Yeah.
Some nice action with all the explosions and stuff.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, the special effects were a bit ropey. I'd be interested to have a look at the revised ones now.
Yeah, it's worth having a look that way. And if you were showing this to somebody else, to a person you were trying to get into Who, then I'd show the version with the new effects. They're not perfect. I mean, they're obviously computer-generated, but they're better than what was there originally.
Mm, yeah.
Just a final word on incidental music. Dudley Simpson, unobtrusive.
Yeah.
And therefore pretty good, probably.
Yeah, I haven't got anything to add to that, really. You know, watching it, I don't recall the incidental music that, as ever, is a good sign. So, yeah, I think it just kind of complements the story well, so it's good.
I can only remember one bit, really, and that's a kind of slightly sort of marching theme for the robot knight, isn't there? Yeah, I mean, it's okay. It's good enough, and it all adds to it without getting on your wick, which is good stuff. Okay, so what, Mark, would you give Time Warrior out of 10, then, Martin?
I'll give it 8 out of 10, I think. I think it's a very strong story. There's a few little bits and pieces that are wrong with it, which we've discussed, but generally it's really enjoyable and it is up there with the better Doctor Who. So, yeah, 8 for me.
Okay, I'll go one extra, I think, and give it a 9. I love it. I really like it. And it loses the point from, you know, a couple of touchy effects and a couple of plot holes here and there, but not enough to really put me off, so... That's a 9 out of 10 for me, and particularly with the new effects, it is a good one, I think, to introduce people to the variety of Doctor Who.
Mm.
And it's one of my favourite types of stories, is the pseudo-historical, you know, the historical setting with sci-fi stuff going on in it.
Yeah, you're right, it is a good one to show to people, because there's nothing particularly laughable about it, other than the opening shot. And that is the trouble with these things, that if you put it on and you see, and immediately the first thing you see is that kind of light going across the sky, which is pretty poor.
Mm.
And then a couple of minutes later you've got it descending down.
Someone shining a torch through a window.
So yeah, with the new effects, that would probably be enough to make it interesting for new people to look at, wouldn't it? Because the Sontaran itself looks really good. And it's a pretty convincing setting, so yeah, good stuff.
Yes, so 8 out of 10 from Martin and 9 out of 10 from me. We got some feedback from listeners.
Okay, so first up we've got T.O. Dimov, who says that it's one of his favourites. Elizabeth Sladen creates a lovely performance in Sarah Jane Smith. John Pertwee is also great in it. A wonderful monster design for the Sontaran and still its best representation so far. Although I do like what they did with them in the new series. I suppose somebody has to. The story also contains one of my all-time favourite cliffhangers, with Lix taking off his helmet for the reveal at the end of episode 1.
Yeah,
totally agree with that. Yeah,
fantastic moment, that one. Yes. Okay. My brother Rob, a big poetry fan, he's written in about this one. He says the premise of an alien crash landing on Earth during the Middle Ages and not finding the technology he needs to make repairs, reaching forward in time to steal scientists and technology, is quite a novel idea. Sarah's disbelief that she has travelled through time is done very well. Yeah, it is. That lasts quite a while, isn't it, before she's convinced that she is actually back in time.
Mm.
The belief that Lynx and the Doctor are wizards makes sense, as they do the impossible by medieval standards. Sarah believing the Doctor is the baddie adds an interesting twist. The dialogue between Irongrin and Blood Axe is excellent, as is the dialogue between Irongrin and Lynx. It all seems well acted, and the castle setting is excellent. The story finishes in a credible way, and there are surprisingly few deaths, which is a good point, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a good point. Who actually dies then? It's just Irongrin and Lynx, isn't it?
Irongrin and Lynx die, and we hear that one of the messengers dies in the dungeon, don't we? But you don't see that on the screen. So, yeah, it's surprisingly few deaths. Hmm. Rob goes on to say there is some comic-like relief with the fighting robot and the Professor Rubish character.
Yeah.
John Pertwee puts in a fine performance, even though he's decided to leave the show at the end of the series. Last but not at all least, the Sontarans are an excellent new monster.
Yep.
Yeah, they certainly don't agree with that. Of course, they don't remain excellent, unfortunately, as we've said.
We got a bit from Jeff Waddell, who says, by the power of Greyskull, it is a tale of medieval mishaps with the first appearance of Sarah Jane, the first and best appearance of a cloned potato in a Keith Lemon voice. Great stuff.
Thanks, Jeff. Mike Wemben, regular contributor. Thanks again, Mike. Fantastic story, maybe the best Pertwee story. Some great characters by Robert Holmes and his usual great dialogue. Irongrin gets all the best lines, a long-shanked rascal with a mighty nose and that narrow-hipped vixen. The design of the Sontaran is at its best here. I can't understand how over the past 30 years or so they've managed to look cheaper and less scary each time they appear. This seems to be some backward evolution. Doc Cotton is also in it, so you can't really argue. Poor old Sarah Jane, the best companion.
Too right. Great, thanks for that, Mike.
That's it for the feedback this time. Thanks very much, everyone. As usual, you can get in contact with us at crinoid@mail.com or go to the blog page at crinoid.blog.co.uk or go to the Facebook page or find us on Twitter. We are at crinoid.
Yeah, so next up, it's the one you've all been waiting for, Simon the Rani.
Oh, I thought you'd forgotten about that one.
No. I didn't just get the title wrong and mean to say the time, were I?
If only you had. So after Time of the Rani, if we're both still alive, we'll be at some point looking at the Troughton story, Seeds of Death, and the Tom Baker story, which we mentioned during this podcast, The Horror of Fang Rock, featuring Louise Jameson as Leela, which is an era of Tom Baker we haven't covered yet.
Excellent. Good stuff. But, of course, first of all, Time of the Rani. You know you want to, Jim. You know you want to.
Yes. So, if any of you out there can bring yourself to watch it, we'd be very interested to hear what you have to say about it, particularly if you can find anything positive.
Oh, Jim. Okay. Well, that's it for this time, I think.
Yes. So, until then, thanks very much for listening this time, and we look forward to having your company again at the next one. So it's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me. See you next time. Thank you.